When my daughter was just starting high school or secondary school, she came to me and she said, "Mom, I'm kind of interested in learning how to play the guitar. I've been playing viola for a very long time, but I want to pick up an instrument that's, I can play more popular music with." So I turned to her and I said, "Honey, you're just starting high school. You already have a lot of activities. Are you sure you really want to add one more thing?" And she turns to me and said, "Well, we already have a guitar. Some of my friends know how to play. It's not a big deal, Mom. Just let me do this thing." And then I look at her and say, "Honey, it's not that easy. If you want to learn to play guitar, we have to find you a teacher. You're going to have to take lessons. You're going to have to practice and really apply yourself." So she pauses. She gives me the look. I get the sigh. And she says, "Mom, that's what the internet is for." So it turns out she's already been online watching YouTube videos about, beginning guitar, and already, kind of able to play on her own. So it was very interesting to me because I study digital kids and I kind of think of myself as a tech-savvy mom, but this conversation brought home to me the really big difference in our assumptions about learning, about technology and the internet, where I'm over here thinking that learning has to be about, hiring an instructor and doing these very structured set of tasks. And she's over here in this world that assumes that learning is about being interested in something and that she can have learning resources at her fingertips whenever she cares to engage. So this is really the challenge in front of us today, that most of our institutions of learning were founded with the mindset that I had, which is of an era when you really did need teachers, you needed our institutions of education, you needed structured sets of engagements in order to have access to specialized knowledge and expertise, versus the generation like my daughter that's growing up in an era where she never didn't have the internet and Google and YouTube videos for every imaginable thing that she's interested in at her fingertips. So it's an incredibly challenging environment because there is this culture gap, but it's also one of tremendous opportunity because the reality is that young people today are growing up in a context of absolute abundance in terms of their ability to access knowledge, to access experts, to have social connections. So how can we best maximize the opportunity that we have today? And I think that's really the subject on the table for us today. So I'll start with a little bit of an overview about some of the research, the statistics around kids these days and digital media. And this is US-centered work, but hopefully we'll have relevance for you here as well. And then I'll talk about this culture gap that we're living through between the old and new ways of learning and engaging with information. And then finally, I'll talk a little bit about connected learning as a model that my colleagues and I in the Digital Media and Learning Initiative have been developing as a way of minimizing some of these gaps and challenges and maximizing the opportunities of today's network world for learning. Okay, so first, a little bit of an overview of how young people are engaging with digital media. So the thing that is, the most fundamental shift that is not a surprise to any of us here in this room is that the volume of engagement with digital media and media in general has been increasing rapidly. So there have been surveys done in the U.S. for about 6 years now tracking young people's time use with media. And over the years, this number just keeps going up and up and up. Now, this is the latest survey. Kaiser used to do the surveys. Now Common Sense Media is doing it. And so you can see that, most of the waking hours, young people are engaged with media of some kind because it's not only information and entertainment that young people are, getting through digital media, but also, social connection. And this has really led to a tremendous rise in how much of our everyday communication and information is being mediated by technology. Now, we look at this and we say, oh my, teenagers these days are so connected, but Common Sense actually did a very similar survey with the parents of these same teenagers, and it turns out that parents' time use with media is even higher than teenagers. So just a reminder here that it's not just the young people, it's all of us that are living in this environment. The other big shift is the interactivity of the media, and you know, this is where you'll be hearing from Katie, who's an expert in on the game side, but it's not just digital media, but it's the interactivity of digital media that's changed. So in the US in 2008, the video game industry passed the movie industry in terms of revenue, and ever since then, it's really become clear that interactive game-like media are the dominant entertainment media of our time. Virtually all teenagers play video games in some form, and there's a pretty even gender split now in terms of video game play as well. And then the final piece that I wanted to highlight is the social engagement. So, you know, as I'm sure is the case here in Germany, you know, more and more through mobile, especially young people, are using digital media of various forms to engage in social relationships. And when we were starting our research in the book that Sylvia mentioned, that was now the field work was about 10 years old, you know, it was still, you know, young people were using MySpace and starting to use Facebook, using a lot of text message to connect with one another, but they still had the sense that it was a little bit creepy to find friends just online, that most of the relationships were, you know, relationships young people had in their school and their community, and they were using social media as a way of reinforcing those existing relationships. And if you asked young people, hey, have you met new friends online, they'd say, not really, that's a little bit creepy. Now, the survey done by Pew in 2015 really showed a dramatic shift where the majority of young people surveyed in the US said that they have actually met a friend first on the internet. And so that social norm is shifting where, you know, it's not simply reinforcing place-based relationships, but young people are turning to the online world to develop new relationships around interests and specialized kinds of communities that they don't have access to in their local communities. So those are some of the broader shifts in terms of what's happening in terms of young people's engagement, their social engagement, their engagement with interactive media. The question for us as educators is what happens when these always connected young people walk into our lecture halls like the one we're sitting in today and encounter our existing frameworks of education. Now, we know that young people usually start their school years very eager and enthusiastic and ready to learn. So this is a survey conducted by Gallup, which is a big survey shop in the US, that looks at student engagement over the years. And you can see that in elementary school, engagement is really, really high. But by the time they reach high school, the majority of young people are disengaged from school. One of my colleagues at UC Irvine did a study of the first 2 years of college where he looked at sort of kind of deep skills like critical thinking and writing skills and what kinds of gains young people made during their first 2 years of college. And he found that almost half of college students demonstrated absolutely no learning gains on those underlying skills during the first 2 years. So what's happening here? You know, why is it that our educational institutions are failing to engage so many young people? Of course, it's not every educational institution, but it's a tremendous proportion of young people who, by the time they're reaching young adulthood, are not having an engaged and positive relationship to our institutions of schooling. Now, this divide between in-school and out-of-school learning, my world and my daughter's world, this is obviously not new. I mean, teachers have always fought this battle about engaging their students. Students have always complained that lectures and worksheets are boring. So that is not a new dynamic. But what has changed is that the world around the classroom has changed so dramatically with the advent of digital media and learning that it's just making that long-standing gap even more acute. The other important thing to realize is this gap between in-school and out-of-school learning it differs based on the level of privilege of the young people. So, you know, again, these are U.S. numbers, but I'm guessing that there are a lot of similar dynamics here as well, where you're seeing in the period from the 70s to 2006, this is the amount of money that families are spending on out-of-school enrichment activities. So that red line is the wealthiest fifth of families, and the bottom line is the poorest. And you'll see that during that period, the wealthy families have tripled their investments in out-of-school learning, where the poorest families have really stayed about the same. So the per student spending of wealthy families in the U.S. has moved from about $3,500 per kid to almost $9,000 a year per child. And what this is showing is really that more and more, the more privileged families are understanding that if they really want to support their young people to learn something specialized, whether it's music or athletics or, you know, coding or other specialties, that they really need to go outside of the school for their young for their child to have that experience of getting really good at something that they're passionate about, to cultivate mentors, to understand how to look a grown-up in the eye, to have that experience of performing or giving something that is making a contribution to a community, and that these experiences of really owning something that is unique to their interests, that they feel a sense of ownership and expertise, that kind of experience is actually fundamental for young people finding their place in the world. And this has always been the case, but is even more so the case in an era when you're surrounded by this constant connectivity, that young people need to learn how to learn, that, you know, they're not necessarily going to be learning all the skills that they need to succeed within the traditional educational curriculum. Now, we hope that today's technologies, especially all these online platforms like Khan Academy and YouTube that are providing all of these free and open online resources, would help mitigate some of those gaps in terms of being able to deliver content that is demand-driven and keyed to young people's interests when they want to know it. And because many of these resources are free or very low cost, you hope that that would help in easing that equity gap between the wealthier families and the poor families. And that's one of the reasons that we've seen this tremendous growth in these online platforms like the MOOCs, the university-based open courses. So there's a tremendous amount of promise there. But more and more research is showing that these kinds of platforms, even when they're free and open, are not necessarily serving the most needy learners. So this is a study done by Hansen and Reich that was published in Science a couple years ago, where they looked at the open courses, the MOOCs from Harvard and MIT. They mapped it onto census data to look at the relationship between socioeconomic and educational attainment between the general population in the US and those who took the online courses. And you'll see here that you know, the pink, the lighter line are the people who took MOOCs, and the dark red line is the general population. And you'll see that overwhelmingly those in terms of income and in terms of educational attainment, especially in terms of educational attainment, that MOOC people who use these resources were both wealthier and more highly educated than the general population. And this is not the only study that has shown that open educational resources are used disproportionately by people who are wealthy and more educated than the general population. It's not exactly surprising, right? If you're looking at open university courses, it's probably the most educated folks in society that are going to take advantage of those. So what they argue is that ideally today's technologies and many of those that are being marketed as democratizing, free and open, ideally they're closing gaps, right? That, you know, you have, because they're free and open, that poorer, less educated people are taking advantage of them at higher rates and closing the gap between the more privileged and the less privileged groups in society. But in reality, what we're seeing is more of this rising tide scenario where people from all walks of life are taking advantage of these resources, but the wealthier and more educated are taking advantage of them at greater levels. So a lot of these technologies are actually increasing the overall gap in terms of equity, even though they are providing important resources to everybody. Okay, so there, so much for the big picture. Let me make it a little bit more concrete. So I want to tell you a story of one young learner. Her name is Tal, or we call her Tal. She was 11 when we spoke to her as part of some of our work around connected learning. And she is a fan of Minecraft. And for those of you who don't know Minecraft, it's a networked game that's a lot like doing Legos, but in a networked multiplayer environment. So about social, building together, building communities together. And Tal first started playing Minecraft at home with her cousin. And then they decided to start a Minecraft club at school. And an important context on the school, which is, you know, Katie will be speaking about more after me, is she, Tal goes to a special school that embraces a game-based approach to learning. And so when these girls went to the teacher, the educators at the school, they said, sure, start a Minecraft club. And they were able to start an after-school club in Minecraft. Because Minecraft is this incredibly like user-generated, openly networked kind of game, there are tons of YouTube videos and resources on the internet for people who are passionate creators of all ages in Minecraft. So if any of you have, you know, a child or student who plays Minecraft, you'll know that, you know, often the majority of time that young people are engaged in Minecraft is actually watching YouTube videos of other Minecraft players and their builds and stories that they've built. And so Tal was one of those kids, and she got very interested in this idea of creating YouTube videos in Minecraft. And then she brought this idea to her club saying, look, let's not just play Minecraft and have our server, but let's make videos together. So as part of this, she started writing scripts for her club to create videos together. You know, they really embraced it. And then the school, again, because it's a school that embraces this kind of learning and out-of-school learning, you know, they featured her in the school newspaper. And then the teachers really encouraged and acknowledged the skills she was gaining in writing and creative production through her engagement with Minecraft. So if you look at Tal's learning, she started with a passionate interest, which was her interest in Minecraft. She had some peers, like her cousin, who supported that interest in learning, but the school provided additional support for her to connect with and gain support from a broader network of peers that shared a similar interest. And then the final piece of the puzzle is that the school was open to meeting those young people where they are, bringing their out-of-school learning, their peer interests into the school environment and connecting it to other academic subjects like writing skills, creative production. And this, in a nutshell, is what we call connected learning. It's those moments when a young person is able to experience learning that's around something that they feel an interest in, that they feel is relevant. They can do it with the support of peers who also share that interest and are supporting their learning. And this last piece is incredibly important. That interest, that kid-driven interest and engagement, is actually tied to achievement within the academic realm. And that third piece is the piece that is often missing in young people's lives. So when we talk to connected to young people, most young people have something they're interested in. And if they're lucky and well-supported, they also have friends and mentors who share that interest and support them. The piece that's missing in almost all cases is that connection back to school, right? So young people may be doing digital media production, they may be doing, gaming outside of school, but the number of kids who are able to connect those kinds of interests into academic learning is very, very rare. So the moral of the story with somebody like Tal is not that the internet or video games creates connected learners, but in fact it doesn't unless you have an environment within the school that is able to connect with those young people's interests. By far the vast majority of young people are in an environment where they have interests that may have some connections to, you know, things they're doing at home. They may be taking an art class in the community. You know, they may have friends that support their interests, but the connections back to school are really tenuous, that they really struggle to connect their own interests, the things they're doing in their community and their peer culture, to things that are happening in school. And part of the reason is that when we think of schooling, a lot of times, in the US at least, we call it a pipeline. So we conceptualize the problem as like, okay, let's start in primary school, and what do we need to do to like bump the kid up to the next level and the next level? And we're just very focused on pushing kids through what we call the pipeline of education, and that if they go through this pipeline, then eventually they will get a job and they'll be fine. Now, when we interview young people, so we do research that's from the young people's point of view, when you look at what it actually takes for a young person to succeed, especially in new and emerging specialties like digital arts or coding, that what they actually have is this incredible network of supports both inside and outside of school. So that pipeline is still very important. But there's also these things happening at home, in the community, in their digital networks, online communities that are supportive and protective of kids continuing to move up through the formal pipeline. And oftentimes, those informal learning environments are not well connected to the formal pipeline. So as educators, part of our job has always been to build connections for young people, whether that's, you know, recommending a summer camp or suggesting a violin teacher or engaging in an after-school club like Tal's teachers did at school. That's part of this act of brokering or connection building is part of what we do as educators. But in today's network world, when there is so much abundance of resources outside of the classroom, those functions, those activities of building those connections, of recommending, suggesting, building relationships with learning outside of school become even more important if we really want young people to be able to tap the advantages that today's network world offers. So some of the research that we've been looking at is really how can educators, caring adults, function as these sort of brokers or connection builders to young people. And we find time and time again that the research shows that when young people have strong relationships with caring adults in different kinds of institutions, whether it's school or the community, that those are the relationships that open up the opportunities for connections to the wider world that might transcend what they have in the family. Parents have always performed that role, but when you come from a background where maybe you don't know a lot of people who are in the technology industry, maybe you don't know a lot of people in these other areas that you might be interested in, then the relationships with mentors and caring adults for young people in those situations becomes incredibly important. So in some of the survey work that my colleague Jean Rhodes has been doing, and she is a specialist in mentoring relationships, she's looking at data that shows that, you know, there are programs that are formal mentorship programs where you take kids who might have fewer advantages and then you connect them to a mentor. But that's really a very small proportion of the kinds of mentoring relationships that young people tend to have in their lives. The vast majority of young people find mentorship through more informal kinds of channels. You know, it may be somebody in a church or faith-based community. It may be an extended family member that, you know, young people who have mentorship relationships tend to discover them in more informal kinds of ways through interest-driven activities, through community-based activities. Now, again, you know, this is where the equity issue starts coming into play again, because you'll see that the pink bar are the more privileged kids and the blue bar are the less privileged kids. The wealthier, more highly educated families, the kids tend to report that they'll have mentors from almost every category at higher rates than the less privileged kids. You know, and this ranges anywhere from family to, you know, neighbors, counselors, coaches, and things like that. So, you know, given that we know the importance of the social relationships and about building connections across settings and the growing abundance of those relationships because of the network world, the question is how, as educators and technology makers and administrators, can we build environments that maximize this opportunity? And that's where, you know, connected learning is both a description of how kids learn in a particular way, but it's also a set of design principles, guiding principles for how we might build environments that support connected learning. So the important thing about connected learning is we're not saying that all learning has to be connected learning all the time, right? So sometimes kids need to learn things they're not interested in, and sometimes they need to be able to just hang out with their friends, and it's not about, you know, getting ahead in life. You know, and sometimes their interests, they just want to do for fun, and it doesn't connect to academic things. So that's fine. But all of these can be entry points into connected learning, into those moments when young people are doing something they genuinely care about, it's socially supported, and it helps them get ahead in life. So you'll see at the center of connected learning, we have both this idea that we're trying to bring together these three spheres of learning, and there's three guiding principles of it being, you know, hands-on, kind of production-centered learning, that there is an openly networked component, and there is a sense of shared purpose, or it's meaningful and relevant that we're doing something together. So I'll close just by giving two examples of environments that have been designed with connected learning principles in mind that have been led by some of our collaborators, my collaborators in the Digital Media and Learning Initiative. So the first is the U-Media Learning Labs, and this is actually started as a library-based kind of youth digital maker space. The Chicago Public Library opened up a really large space within their main downtown public library to focus on teen digital making. My colleague Nicole Pinkert and colleagues at Carnegie Mellon University built out this space that was really focused, again, on this production-centered principle. So it's all about making digital media, ranging from music to spoken word to graphics, gaming. And the important thing about this is it wasn't just individual students doing individual projects, but they designed these shared endeavors where the community came together to do things together that were relevant and making genuine contributions back to the community. So, for example, the gamers didn't just play games together. They did a podcast game review that they posted on the internet and shared with each other. The music kids did their own record label and released their own CDs. The spoken word kids you'll see here, they have a weekly open mic night where they perform for the entire community. And they also engage in citywide competitions as well. So the activities are located within communities where they're making genuine contributions. And then finally, even though this is an environment that's a place-based intervention, they made an active effort to have their work to engage within the broader online and local community in Chicago, like publishing the podcast on the internet and getting a broader audience. When they have a fashion program, they set up a Tumblr and share all their work. The spoken word kids compete in both regional and national competitions. And then importantly, the space is staffed by teaching artists who are still practicing artists. So they have connections, relationships in the community and abroad, which makes them ideal brokers for kids' interests beyond that actual space. And then the final example that I'll talk about is the nonprofit that Katie and I have started called Connected Camps, which is really an effort to take the online communities in environments like Minecraft. We're also working with Scratch and understanding how we can build a wrapper of educational support around existing youth digital interests that have a lot of potential in terms of academic outcomes. So, Minecraft is already a production-centered space, so that's why we chose it. Kids are making, building, doing things together collaboratively within the online world. And the piece that we really bring to it is bringing the shared purpose principle. So we train high school and college counselors to work with the younger kids, and they design design challenges, epic builds, and things that the kids do together so that they're not just playing around as they would normally within Minecraft, but they're really using the environment to engage in more challenging kinds of production, coding, things like that. And then Minecraft is already an openly networked environment, so our counselors, our kids, are able to connect with a much broader network of resources and communities in the Minecraft ecosystem. So those are just two examples of efforts that have been trying to put connected learning in practice. I would love to hear more about what you all have been engaging in here, and if you see any resonances with all of this work. We are trying to build a community around connected learning. The bad news about connected learning is there's no silver bullet. It really isn't just one technology, one way of doing things, one form of practice, and it really requires connections, relationships across a really wide range of players, both inside and outside of school, in order to support this kind of learning for young people. But the good news about connected learning is that everybody has a role to play, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a coach, whether you're a technology maker, an administrator, or an expert who has something to share, we all have a role to play. So we're building this community. We'd love to have your participation and engagement. We run an annual conference. It'll be in October this year in Southern California. It'll be beautiful, sunny, lots of fun people. So come join us. And then we try to put all of our resources online, and we have a pretty active community on various social media channels. So we try to practice what we preach in terms of the openly connected side of things. So thank you very much.